who has actually used the small whiteboard technique in their classes before? Okay, so two people. Okay, great. You get to learn something new. So, core concepts of quantum theory. So, this is the first of the enrichment presentations. And really, this is not... Working? Okay.
You're a genius.
Great. Thank you, Dave. So first enrichment presentation. So what we'll be doing is looking at purpose of these, point of these. These will take up largely most of the mornings. Then we'll look at the double slit experiment, which a lot of you will know. Essentially looking at various experiments, you have a wall, you have two narrow holes or slits in it, and what happens, what sort of pattern, or really how various types of objects, waves, particles, and electrons go through that. And then look at what I see as being four of the key, most crucial concepts of quantum mechanics, of quantum theory. If you're actually trying to distill it down to its essence, and they are the wave-particle duality, the fact that quantum entities, electrons, protons, photons, have a bit of waviness to them sometimes, that's like waves, but also a bit of a particle-like nature. The idea of superposition, genuine randomness, that when you get down to the atomic level, what quantum physics says at face value is that things like individual radioactive decays cannot be predicted with certainty. They're intrinsically random. They just happen. And finally, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You cannot know both the position and the velocity of the particle, where it is and how fast it's gone. And then finally finish up on why is quantum theory so tough to understand. So the purpose of the enrichment presentation. So these are not directly for your students. We're not thinking of these presentations directly to lift and take to your students. But really, these are directly for you. And these are to give you a deeper, richer understanding of all the modern physics that you teach. And also to increase your confidence with them. So it's really these presentations are for you. What sort of underlies this is sort of the core concepts philosophy, you might think. And one question that really starts from is, at the end of the day, what do you most want your students to walk out of your classroom remembering about modern physics? What are the most important things about modern physics you'd really like them to get, you'd really like to stick in their minds? And one answer to that is probably not that it was 1905 was Max Planck who came up with black body radiation, or it was 1926 Erwin Schrödinger, the Schrödinger equation. So historical aspects, but more just the key, essential, fundamental understanding and ideas and points. And so one answer to that question is the core concepts of quantum theory and special relativity. That practically speaking, well, there's a quote there consistent with that from David Potts, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. As teachers, we always seek to compress and simplify all the developments that have come before. We want to bring our students as quickly as possible to the frontier of current understanding. From this perspective, the actual history, which involves many variants and missteps, is only a hindrance. Now, he's talking at teaching at the university level, but I think there's some translation there to all different levels. And that, realistically, given that you have a very limited, constrained amount of time to teach modern physics, one idea is to cut to the chase, get to the key, essential core points. And that's really sort of underlying this philosophy of the core concepts, and this is what we'll look at this morning. So, the double slit experiment. So, I'd like you to imagine a brick wall, so it's a vertical brick wall with a narrow slit. So, it's kind of hard to get the perspective right, but it's a brick wall that's kind of standing up like this, and there's some narrow hole in there, and behind that, again, is another vertical brick wall. And you're down there, and maybe you have just this huge bucket full of tennis balls. And you also have a bucket of paint. And you actually get tennis balls out one by one, and you dip them in the paint, they're black, and then you throw them in some sort of semi-haphazard manner towards the slit. So that some of them go through and then hit the far wall, and others sort of hit here and then bounce off. So you're not exactly precise, you don't have a laser sight, you're not actually getting every tennis ball exactly the same spot. But we're not really concerned about the ones that hit the front wall and bounce off. We're just concerned about the ones that get through. So what I'd like to ask you is just a warm-up question. After you've thrown, say, 1,000 tennis balls, what, roughly speaking, what kind of pattern of paint splotches would you get on the rear wall? And I should say, this is kind of the view from above, so an aerial bird's eye view. So the walls are vertical, so we have the slit there, and then a vertical wall here. So I should say, this is actually meant to be an incredibly easy question. So I think last week we had a few people that thought, well, it's perimeter institute theoretical physics, it can't be as simple. So we'll go think about all sorts of complex patterns of the balls ricocheting off the walls and what their invisible force fields and quantum particles and stuff. So none of that. None of that whatsoever. So it's meant to be an incredibly simple question. And so we have four possible options. There's one here. We can see what they are, A, B, C, and D. So what I would like you to do, so two things. So the first thing is, so one of those answers is correct, and three, obviously, you're incorrect. So I'd like you to discuss in a minute, not now, but in a minute with the people around you, which of those you think is correct. And then once you have it, write your answer down on the whiteboard. And once you've done that, if you've done that, I'd like you to look at the three answers you think are incorrect, and think about and discuss and find out which misconceptions you think students might have in their heads that would lead them to quote the or give the other three answers that you think are wrong to the question. So the right answer plus what misconceptions would lead or be consistent with the other three wrong answers. So I will give you 3 minutes to talk to the people around you and come up with the answer.
Okay, 30 more seconds.
Okay. Yes.
It's bouncing a lot.
Sorry?
He's bouncing a lot.
What sort of bouncing are you talking about? Oh no, the no bouncing allowed. They would not bounce back far enough.
Really old tennis balls.
Yeah, very old tennis balls. Lost a lot of their elasticity. So now it's a chance for me as a teacher to get an idea of whether I've been effective, whether I'm at the right level, and so forth. So, you know, I can try and read your body language and see if there are any confused looks and furrowed brows, but that's not always effective. So if everyone can raise up their... Okay. Great. Everyone's awake this morning. Fantastic. So all A's there, so that's great. So that's really good as a teacher. So, I mean, I knew that. You know, you're smart people. We've got thousands of applications and, like, the top 40 here. Well, approximately thousands. So, but it's very, very good. But if there was, for example, if it was half A's, half C's, then I knew that a fair number of people were not getting it. And then so I know that either, say, I might have to go and think about another way of explaining it or go a bit more in depth. Or another thing that's actually a very excellent idea is to say to all the people that have got A's, okay, find someone that had a C, a different answer to you, and then actually discuss and go back and forth and see why you had your answer, why then they had their answer. And that can be very good as sort of peer instruction. So it's a very, very useful technique. Really a snapshot of what is going on in the student's mind. Fantastic. And we do actually have a bit more of that at the physics education research talk. So that's Thursday afternoon, Glenn Wagner. He uses that in his class. We'll be talking about that. So great, everyone got the correct answer, A. So what I'd like to do is just change the situation very, very slightly. Imagine we'll just move this lid along from being slightly to the left to slightly to the right. And do the same thing, 1,000 tennis balls, dip them in paint, throw them in this roughly haphazard manner, not completely identically, at the wall here. And we get the same sort of pattern, just obviously shift along, being in line here with the second wall. So, sorry, this sleeve here. So, now, Shane, make one more modification, and that is have two slits open. So, one gap there, one gap there. Again, the same configuration. It's kind of hard to get the actual perspective, but vertical walls, one behind the other, and do the same thing. And if we did that, what I'll do is, again, I'll throw it up to you. What pattern, roughly speaking, just trying to get the basic qualitative features, would we get in this situation? So we have, again, hard to do. This is sort of vertically from above. These are the two slits. And I guess the perspectives are different, so this is looking from above. But here is actually looking, I guess, directly at the wall. So if the wall was here, then this pattern or the final rectangles you see would actually be what you would see from looking directly at a horizontal perspective. So what I'd like you to do is rub off the answers you had before, and then maybe it looks like everyone got the last one. So I'll give you 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes to talk to people around you. Think about which pattern you think is the correct one. And also, again, what student misconceptions might lead your students to come up with the three answers that you think are wrong. What might be going through their minds to come up with the erroneous answers. So, 2.5 minutes.
Like the person.
Yes. Most of the time it's besides the way that it's not. I guess I'm used to it. Oh, when I go in front of there. Okay. Okay. So again, I'll get a snapshot of the class, what you're thinking, how you're going. So everyone put up the... So... Great, fantastic. B, answer B. So just consensus sum of the two, a whole bunch of particles from there, and from there, fantastic. So this sort of behavior we didn't have to is typical of... this sort of pattern we've seen is actually typical of what you might call particles. So we didn't have to use tennis balls. We could have used billiard balls instead, or if we actually had the dimensions right, somehow we had some machine that fired out grains of sand, we could have done that. Or rocks or bullets or any other type of sort of small or solid compact objects, localized objects. And so the kind of patterns we've seen are typical behavior of particle-like behavior, those sort of patterns. So what I'd like to do now, consider the double slit experiment again, or at least a single slit experiment now, but let's think about water waves. So either a ripple tank, or actually thinking about real waves at the beach, or in an ocean, or in a lake, and a similar sort of setup you might have, in essence, is with water waves replacing the tennis balls. Imagine we have some kind of a sea wall at the start of a harbor to protect it, the boats inside the harbour from rough storms and seas. We could imagine the seawall with the gap. And again, this is really a view from above. So we have, looking from above, there's the water here. And I guess when a helicopter looks from a couple of hundred metres up. So imagine we have a plane wave that's at right angles on the wall. So this wave is coming maybe from out in the ocean here, coming along this direction here. So we have, this is... Again, view from above, the wavefronts, successive wavefronts, that arrow indicating the direction of the motion. What we have, this wave, and a wave, you can think of that as a field. And every point along the water, every point in the bay, the harbor, the ocean, or whatever we have, the lake, you'll find there'll be an amplitude for that wave. And that's just a number describing the height of the wave, really above the mean position, or the whatever position we define as being zero, which is probably going to be where the water is when it's still. There's sort of no wind or no water. So we have the amplitude. Let's denote that by the single capital A. So every single point out in space, here again, this is a view from above, we have an amplitude. And obviously where you have the crests, the peaks of the waves, highest amplitude, greatest amplitude, and troughs, lowest amplitude, negative amplitude. So, we specify the amplitude everywhere, and what happens, it comes to the slit here, and then the wave actually spreads out, you know, it diffracts as it goes through this narrow barrier here, and we end up, we want to look at a pattern of the intensity of the wave as it changes with this distance here, with this x distance along the axis. What we find is that we get some sort of pattern, at least in the middle here, some sort of intensity pattern like this. So it's, again, it's kind of hard to get the perspective, but what we have is, this, I guess, is looking not from above, but really looking at, I guess, this x-axis here, the distance along here, and then we have really the y-axis here, the intensity. So it's really showing us a graph, just as we move along here, how the intensity changes. And one way of imagining it, so if we have water here, and we had actually a little row of corks or buoys, and we had them all lined up, just attached to each other with some string. What we could do is actually just see how much or how high these corks or these buoys are bobbing up and down, And if we did that, what we would find is the ones right near the middle there would be bobbing up and down as much. There's a great amount of energy there. And as we go through, basically, we're getting further and further away from the source here. So the wave is spreading out more like a ripple in a pond. And the intensity dies off reasonably quickly. And obviously, the details of the pattern, this is just very, very rough, but the details of the pattern, what we would see, depend on the wavelength of the wave, the distance from here to here, and also the split width. But essentially, this is, if we look at the most important qualitative details, getting to the essence of it, this is what you would see. So that's one slit. So let's think about what happens with two slits. You get the good old standard two-slit diffraction pattern. And if we gain same situation, but we add another hole or knock out another part of the wall, of the seawall, again, looking from above, we have slit one here, slit two here, this is the x-axis along here, then what we have is, again, a plane wave coming through here, an idealized plane wave. We have that this little slit here acts as a source of a roughly spherical wave, so the plane wave comes through here and acts as a wave source, and then we get these wave fronts, sort of circular type wave fronts expanding out, and we have for all the waves coming out of there, some amplitude at every point in space. We have the amplitude of the wave there. We'll call that A slit 1. And same thing for the second slit here. Oh, actually, that's A slit 2. The first slit here, same thing. And so what we notice, two slits, there are sort of two, in a sense, sources of the waves. And notice that the total wave, we're looking on the x-axis here, at every point, we get superposition. That the total pattern, if we want to find pick any particular point after past the first two slits here, and especially here along the second wall where we might have a row of quarks or a row of coils. Sorry, you've got a...
Can you follow those nodes and antinodes, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay, so at this point here, we want to find out what the amplitude is any point along this x-axis here. What we have to do is find the amplitude from coming from the first slit and the amplitude emanating from the second slit. Add them together, superpose one over the top of each other, and that gives us the total amplitude. And that's, of course, why if they're, say, the same sign, there are two crests, if you like, they're both positive, you get a greater amplitude. Constructive interference, you might get here, and here, and here. And this is, again, just a very, very rough pattern to give you the essential qualitative features. Or if you have a crest and a trough, positive and negative amplitude, obviously destructive interference, and you get these points here, basically where you get very little intensity, where you get the cancellation of the waves. And in between, you get partial cancellation, partial reinforcement, so you either get a complete peak or the completely destructive interference. And if we want to find out the intensity, this is a graph of the intensity is the square of the amplitude, the square of the total amplitude there. So essentially this is, yes?
I saw that right off the bat. When do the amplitudes added together? I thought that's what we said.
Oh, yes, you do, yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. So A is, do you mean that A is the sum of the two?
If A is a value of 3, say then it's not 9.
Sorry?
A has a value of 3, the amplitude would not be 9. It wouldn't be a squared intensity.
Oh,
the intensity.
Yeah, so what I mean is the intensity is equal to the square. So maybe, you're worried about, is it this line here?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't understand that.
Oh, the
the intensity
why
should be twice the value
of
the amplitude.
No, it's the square
of
the amplitude.
So maybe if I put big brackets around there, would that help? So maybe I should have. I'm not sure if this is it, but.
I think I know what.
Confusion between intensity and amplitude.
Yes. Does that clarify things?
No. What do you mean by essentially?
Well, my intensity is proportional to the energy that you actually have there. It's relative to the energy, and you get the intensity to square the amplitude. Sorry? I'm not sure what the question is.
I think that there's confusion between A of x representing the deviation from the mean,
uh-huh.
the intensity being the square of the amplitude of that function, as opposed to the intensity being that. That's not the, is that the graph of the intensity, or is it just the graph of the deviation from the
No, that's the graph of the intensity. Maybe I should get the axes right, but that would give you the graph, the intensity graph.
Also.
Yeah, intensity. I mean, that's so if you have, I guess, so if you have the zero line being there, so the x-axis here and the intensity being zero there, and then going up, essentially an intensity axis going up like that.
So is that a of x represents what?
Sorry?
What does A of X represent?
The amplitude.
After superposition.
The amplitude. So
it's the same the amplitude. Does that? Okay, if there are any more. So A will always be amplitude. You get the intensity from the amplitude and measure the energy. You have to square the amplitude. So, okay, moving on. So this is just the standard double slip. Interference pattern, double slip with the amplitude and the intensity. So, and it's not just limited to water waves, that you could get it with light waves, any type of electromagnetic radiation waves, also acoustic waves, sound waves. So, various different types of waves can give you the same sort of pattern. So it's something that's gained, just like it wasn't something special. That tennis ball is the pattern that we saw before. The sort of interference pattern is generic, feature of all different types of waves you find in nature. So getting more into quantum physics, the interesting thing is that people have actually done the double slit experiment with electrons. And that's reference there was done sometime, I believe, in the 1980s. And so let's look at how what happened with electrons. I mean, are electrons like tiny, tiny scale down minute billiard balls or tennis balls? Or are electrons perhaps more like tiny, tiny, tiny scale down very, very small wavelength waves? So we'll all get something that fits in with the water wave pattern. Or they're not the two options. It's not as if everything in nature has to be a wave or a particle. It might be, I don't know, a shadow or some string or one other type of strange fundamental entity. So let's have a look. This is science. Let's see what they found out with the experiments. So again, let's consider what happens if we just have one slit open. So single slit electron pattern. So again, looking from above, we have just one slit open. And to give you an idea of what they actually did in this experiment was done in Japan. The slit width was around about 1 micrometer. They had a very, very hot filament, kind of an electron gun, if you like, very, very hot metal that it sends fired out the electrons in some reasonably haphazard manner. And you can see the velocity is incredibly quickly, more than a third of the speed of light, 120,000 kilometers per second. So incredibly fast. And they had a reasonably large distance between wall A and wall B. And I just say those just because those kind of give the main parameters. This is what we have. And just as so quantum physics, if you want to represent an electron, in a sense, it's a little bit like waves. If you have a water wave spreading out a ripple in a pond, you have an amplitude or a field for the wave at every single point. And in quantum physics, you have the same thing. The technical term is a wave function, but aside from that, we have this sort of field or an amplitude. So to distinguish it from just the amplitude A for the water wave, let's give it a special different symbol. And so let's give it the symbol psi, a letter of the Greek alphabet. So we have psi here. And at every point on the space here, we have this psi, this amplitude, if you like. This field, which is in a sense similar. It's sort of analogous to the field that we have, or the amplitude we have, the waves at every point. But what we'll see, this is more, in a sense, like a probability amplitude or a probability wave. That what it does give you is really sort of an idea. The larger it is, essentially, or the greater the magnitude of it, the more likely you are to find an electron here or at that particular point, because it's a probabilistic thing in quantum physics. So we have this analogous field, and we have the spreading out, this diffraction effect of the in a sense, the electron field. And Okay. So what I'd like to do is open it up to you now. So what they did, the experiment, and there are four possible different patterns that they may have gotten there with the slip. And so what I'd like you to do is get your whiteboards out again and talk to the people around you, and then find out and decide which pattern that you think they actually would have seen in that experiment. Again, with the electrons, they're firing them out in a somewhat haphazard manner. It's not a precision experiment where each electron, and again, this is thousands and thousands of electrons, it's a large number of electrons that they're firing out over a period of time. And it's not as if they, again, precisely get them going exactly the same spot. There's some sort of distribution initial of them you can see here. So what sort of pattern would you expect to find at the final wall that if you had a whole series of electron detectors here, or cameras if you like, that could measure where each electron hits along the wall, what sort of pattern would you see in terms of the probability of finding the electrons? Because we have a thousand, let's say 1,000 electrons we're firing against the wall here. Again, this is sort of a view from above, and then this is kind of strange, it's more of a horizontal view. And if you look at along, this is the x-axis here, along here, we might have a graph of probability versus the x-axis. And so we won't find, well, each electron being at exactly the same spot, that we'll find, say, 100 electrons here, and 50 electrons there, and 25 electrons there. And so what that means, it's a probabilistic thing. So we'll get some sort of pattern or probability distribution for the electrons and where they hit along the wall. And what I'd like you to do is to get the probability distribution for the electrons and find out what that would be. So I'll give you 2 minutes to, or 3 minutes to discuss it with people around you. And also think about, if you get the answer, think about what the other distributions, what sort of misconceptions people would have to get the other distributions. So this is not your I didn't understand what you're asking for.
You
No, generally, no, it's just. But I think the intensity will, and that's the intensity of that, what I just created. But what do we have is we would have a Y and C. And we add them as a function of X, Y, as the anti-graph, and if you I agree. So I think I agree with you, I think we agree that we're all the same. Show up your hand, your cards. Great. A depends on where the wave function is for that. Okay. So mostly A is there. So yep. So that is correct.
So
yes.
I do have one little question.
Yes, sure.
I understand why we're getting the extra bumps on the inside.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so as you go on that. Is it because basically what you're getting is almost two sources of diffracts on each edge? Is that basically why you're getting the interference pattern of it?
So this actually is not an interference pattern, it's a diffraction pattern.
Because if you go back a couple of pages, the way you did the waves and that, the water and that, and the light, you didn't put in any one there.
Now, right there, you get the same thing too, right? You get the same thing too. Okay.
And that's my question. I know it's a right. Lot of topic. I want to know why do you get, because I mean, this picture of the waves coming out, you should get it's pattern like this. Why do you get the extra ripples on the inside?
Okay, so why you get the extra ripples is essentially that's because of diffraction. And so the easiest way to think about it is, when the electrons, so again, you've got to not think of electrons. To actually understand that, you can't think of electrons obviously as being tiny, tiny, hot, solid, hard little tennis balls or marbles or something like that. But more think of them in terms of the wavy aspect, the spread out thing. But the easiest way to think about it is that you have, this is the, the electrons coming here, that if you divide up, every point along the aperture of the slit that you have, you can think of each of those points along there as actually being the source of a wave in itself. So it's a Huygens wavelet type thing. So you know that, yeah. That's the easiest way to understand it. Yes, Mark.
A quick question. The way you phrased the question, you said which one would you expect? So we kind of took a step back. And he said,
okay.
If we didn't already.
Oh, have okay. Yeah.
Wave theory,
right.
Expected.
Okay.
Wave more like.
Okay.
Or perhaps be. So okay. My question to you then is, how do you get from C to A? How do you go from saying?
How do you get the students?
Right.
Right.
So in terms of what you said, about, you have to think about the electrons as this form of blah, 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 blah. Perhaps if you could elaborate on the blah, 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 blah.
I thought it was self-explanatory. So that's an excellent question. That gets into the pedagogy. Excellent point. So maybe... what would have been better if I'd been clear and said what did they see? So yeah, what did they see? But how, I mean, you're saying, if I understand you right, how do you get the students from thinking over? Because most students do think of them as tiny little solid hot particles. How do you get them from there to this wavy aspect? Excellent question. We could have a whole workshop on that. I guess one technique I use, we'll show some videos in a minute, is, in a sense, confront them with the results of the experiments, where you do see experiments with electrons, and you see the wavy patterns and the wave-like nature, and we'll see one in a little while. And those, it's just, you shock them into at least doubting the idea that electrons are tiny scaled-down particles, because the patterns you see, essentially, you can see the double slit interference pattern. Okay. And they've done this experiment, we'll see a video in a minute. And hopefully get some sort of cognitive dissonance going, hang on, if they really are, you would not expect that. Okay. So I'm sure actually over lunch, there'd be a lot of people here that have a lot of ideas about that. But that's one thing I do. I mean, in a sense, show them, there are a lot of experiments you can show them, that, tennis balls don't interfere. They don't diffract. You get that with electrons.
So I might be ahead of myself. This might be addressed in the video or something like that. But in terms of how to think about the electron, it's fine and dandy to see the results of it behaving like a wave, but how do you picture it?
Didn't Maxwell?
How do you visualize?
What is it? I know. I'm just playing.
This gets into, one of the keynote presentations on Friday, we'll get into that. So the short answer, 30-second answer is, it's very subtle, and it is really hard, and I don't think we have this one single coherent picture, but one answer is sometimes it's good to get a picture of thinking of it as this waterway that spread out is good, and sometimes thinking of it as a particle is good. It's got this weird hybrid. Of two. Yes?
I can't see how a student would visualize the pattern being C.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's thinking of it as a particle,
right.
Wouldn't they look at it in terms of only going directly through the slit and get more of a B picture?
Yeah.
Not with a single dot, though, but with
like we had before.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I agree with that. So they probably would. So you're saying if you did this directly with students, you'd probably shift it around or have more of do it another way or have a pattern like that.
How would you get that probability that's shown in CDO. Like I can't even.
How does quantum physics predict it, or how
would you predict it or expect it? Like why is that a choice there?
What would your misconception be to choose C as the answer?
Can I tell you mine?
Okay.
I just said that we know that the ray gun shows these arrows going like this. It's haphazard.
Yeah.
We know that it's 10 to the negative 6, which is way huger than an electron, which means that
if it exits that ray gun from the right edge and comes over to the left, there's got to be some sort of margin error which doesn't exist in B. Okay. So we just said C, and there's a whole bunch of fun stuff happening on the other side. So
okay. Yeah. John, yeah.
Now, isn't C an option if it was curved and you've got the problem? Because right there, if it is a straight line, there's a spot where it's zero probability. But in a true single slit, if the slit's small enough, isn't C a possibility?
Oh, right. C could just be a very wide
It could be a very small slit. And just spread up, but because it's a straight line, you're getting a spot with zero probability. Because if that's a straight line, because if that is a curve, that is a better equivalent possibility because of the size of the slip.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I agree with that. So possibly this could be. I mean, you could think of this as being just a stretched out.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That's right. So then. So then maybe it would have been better just to make this little more distinctive, so it's clear. So put a little hole in it, dip in it somewhere, and just make it so that it was wrong but consistent. Yeah. Okay. Good point. I remember that for 2007.
You already gave us the data.
Right.
I can tell you the wavelength. Oh. The copper then, this C couldn't happen.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the wavelength of the electron just.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, thank you. I hadn't done that. So, did you have a question? No? Comment?
I reconsidered what I asked.
Okay. Okay. No, this is good. It's exactly what we want, this discussion. Fantastic. Okay, so this is good. This is good. So we've got this idea. Okay, I'm skipping a few things. So we have again, remember for water wave we have this A sort of amplitude, sort of every point in space is spread out thing. We get exactly the same thing, psi subscript E for an electron. And it's all in space, but it's not really sort of a wave, it's more like a probability wave or a probability amplitude. And when we square it, and technically we have to sort of take the modulus of it, the magnitude of it, then square it, because it could be a complex number, so you want to make it real, and then you square that. But that's not really important. But essentially we're basically squaring it here. If we get the amplitude of a wave, you square that, you get the intensity. When we get this sort of the probability field for an electron, if you square that, you don't get an intensity, but you get a probability because we're finding an electron at a particular point. And it is a strange thing, and this gets us this key point, even though the picture we have in quantum physics of electrons, so like when we're not looking at them and they're traveling through the slit and towards the wall, we represent them by this spread out wave, this probability wave. But when we actually measure them, we have detectors against this wall here. You do actually see localized little dots and spots. The electrons hit there, each individual electron hits there, there, or there. So it's very, very strange. So in some senses, there's a spread out wave, and that when we actually look at the electron, we measure it, it actually collapses. And actually to a localized point, and that's the collapse of the wave function. So this is also a very deep, very, very strange thing, and it's a sort of a disanalogy with water waves. If we do have spread out water waves, but we see them actually as being spread out. You have one wave going through a seawall, you actually see the energy spread out over a considerable area. But it's as if, in a very crude way, and actually I forgot to bring my one of my favorite books in, but they showed you Quantum MacGyver Perplexed. Actually, maybe I'll just write that up. By Jim Alfley. And I always remember it because it has a very distinctive name, but.
I have a few, like, Coffee.
Oh, okay. Did you win that last night? Okay. Just tell me if the name is spelled wrong. So it's a popular book. So I don't think there are any equations, or maybe there's one or two equations in there. So it's very descriptive. It goes through the double slit experiment. It could be something you could give a student. If you had a very keen student, you could give them. It's very accessible. And then it goes, it's got a lot of modern stuff, quantum computing, quantum teleporters, and so forth. Standard model quarks and things like that. So it's quite up to date, gives you an idea, and it's accessible for the students. But also, if you wanted to get a deeper understanding of things, especially what's happening now in quantum physics, recent research, and also goes through the interpretations of quantum physics, like Schrodinger's cat, entangled, all those weird, strange philosophical issues, many worlds interpretation. And I just like his writing style. I think it's very, very good. So that's Damien's book recommendation for today. Okay. Why I did mention that is one thing that he talks about is there's one line I remember. He says, for electrons and other quantum particles, it's as if they're waves when we're not looking at them, but as soon as we look at them, in a very, very crude way, they kind of collapse into becoming particles. Why exactly that happens, no one knows. But there'll be more on that on Friday, the Hans Westman in the keynote presentation. So we have this sort of probability wave for an electron. And again, two key points is when the electrons, they always hit at spot, they're localized. And we get the fraction between walls A and B.
Maybe I'm not a what is the difference between the probability wave and the probability density? Like, how can you square one together? I mean, what is the fundamental difference?
What is the fundamental difference? So the fundamental difference is exactly the difference between the amplitude of a wave and the amplitude of a water wave and the intensity of a water wave. I mean, the main thing is an amplitude can be a positive or negative thing, a crest or a trough. But the probability or the intensity, it's always zero or greater. Oh. So there's sort of a mathematics and the sign, but it's exactly the difference. Between those two. Yes?
I remember when I took quantum mechanics, like, is it right to say there's kind of no real physical significance to the probability amplitude? Because you said, like,
right.
It's a complex number,
yeah.
So it's like, what, until you square
So a lot of physicists would agree with you, but this is something physicists still debate for hours and hours on end while they're drunk at pubs. So if you probably talk to most physicists, they would agree with you and say, look, it's not a physical thing. It's not something out there in space, this sort of psi. It's more just this mathematical tool that represents our knowledge. Although there are some you can find that do actually believe that it is a physical wave, although it gets kind of hard to believe that when you get more than one particle. Just technically, if you get two particles or three particles, then this wave is actually in three times n dimensions, where n is the number of particles you have. So if you have two electrons, then it's actually a six-dimensional wave. Three electrons is a nine-dimensional wave. And you kind of have to believe in these dimensions, really, if you want to believe in that, which some people do, but most people would agree with you there. Yes?
So, although the wave function size is a complex quantity, mm-hmm. you can think of it as a two-component.
Oh, yes, yeah.
For
yep.
instance, in electromagnetic field, you can think of the electric field and the magnetic field as a two-component
mm-hmm.
field.
Yep.
So if you represent a Maxwell's equation in complex form, for instance, mm-hmm. you use a psi, you define psi as electric field plus I magnetic field,
yep.
then you can just recast Maxwell's equation into Schrodinger's form.
Okay.
So I don't think that you can just say that, because wave function is complex, then it mm-hmm. has no statistical significance.
Yeah.
You probably should just interpret it as a two-component field.
Okay, yeah, definitely. You can interpret it as two real components, so yeah, true. But then you do get the disanalogy between Maxwell's equations and Schrodinger equation and configuration space versus space. Yep, excellent point. Great. Okay, so okay. So actually, I might just do this slide, and so it's about 1:15 now. We've got a keynote presentation in about 15 minutes. So I'll just finish this slide, then we'll take a little bit of a break. So what happens if we close slit 1, open slit 2? So one slit open, then we have the same pattern as before, except it's just shifted along. So that kind of makes sense. And so what we're going to do is what happens when you actually open both slits. And I'll show a little while, a little video of the experiment. But so that brings us to the end of the first session. So the routine is we actually have out there, so you will be having your lunches out there in our bistro from 12 to 1. But we have a little, actually, I'll just check that everything's, it should be out by now. Yeah, actually, that would be good. So I'll just keep looking. So we will have coffee breaks out there in the morning and the afternoon. So we have a keynote presentation on cosmology at 10:30, one of our researchers, Justin Corey. So actually, I should have, it's fine. So, oh, actually, I'm not sure if I mentioned this, but I'll say that now. There's a slight shift in the schedule. We have the keynote presentations. If you look, there's one today, Thursday, and Friday. They're down from 1 to 2 p.m. We tried that last week, and we found that generally people, some people would go to lunch, and you're kind of lethargic after lunch, and you're not in the most attentive mood. So we found that really wasn't the best time, so we shifted them to the morning so you could really get full value out of these. We have some of our best expert, researchers, world experts in their field, so really want you to be awake and prepared for that. So I'm not encouraging you to over-drink coffee, but make sure you're awake. So we have, basically when you get back, put everyone back here at 10:30 on the dot.
Can I say one thing? Our snack is the one on the big table. There's often a smaller coffee break snack on the little table. That's the researchers, and sometimes we go through and clear out both, and they come up and they're like, where's our coffee break? So we're supposed to stick to the big table.